A difficult reading, and one not always read during Advent. We give the impression sometimes, don't we, that Christmas is all twinkle twinkle, angel choirs, fluffy lambs, starlit skies, sweet smelling hay and a baby, meek and mild, sleeping peacefully. If we come to Christmas only through carols, Christmas cards and nativity plays, we could be forgiven for thinking that Jesus was born into an idyllic world, peaceful, serene, a fairy tale place where nothing bad ever happened, or if it did, bad things only happened to bad people. The Gospels testify otherwise, as does history beyond the Bible. Jesus was born into a world in which bad things happen to good people, not occasionally or atypically, but relentlessly, inescapably. Jesus was born into a world in which the innocent suffered, a world in which those who unleashed great suffering flourished and prospered. At least that's how it seemed. This morning, we skip over the discovery of Mary's pregnancy, Joseph's resolve to minimise the harm done to Mary while extricating himself from the betrothal, his dream, and the birth of the baby and its naming by Joseph. We return to that part, that episode, on Christmas Day. But this morning's reading, it's not told from Joseph's perspective. It introduces a cast of powerful baddies, and some sincere, yet sadly naive, wannabe goodies from the East. It's the time of King Herod. Born into an influential Idumean family, Rome appointed young Herod governor of Galilee. Herod won more favour in Rome by supplementing the enormous taxes he extracted from Galilee with lavish gifts given to important and influential people. Now, he was brutal, and the Senate of Rome censored his brutality, but it had little incentive to bring any consequences to a client king who delivered so much. At the time, Herod was in Galilee, and Judea was an independent Jewish kingdom ruled by the priestly Hasmonean dynasty. Then the rival princes among the Hasmoneans began to compete for the kingship. There was civil war. Herod seized the opportunity, went to Rome, was appointed king of the Jews, returned to Judea with Rome's armies, conquered the city and the region, and brought Judea back under Roman control. By the time Jesus was born, Herod had become Herod the Great. He ruled a substantial kingdom under Rome, which after his death, Rome divided between his surviving sons. Herod's construction projects were engineering and architectural marvels. The Jerusalem Temple, Caesarea Maritima to the north, Masada, the fortress that featured in the Jewish War. Monumental works like these don't come cheap. As well as extracting enormous taxes to send to Rome, Herod raised even more taxes and conscripted workers for his building projects, for his armies, for his lavish Roman-style courts. He was ambitious. His ambition cost ordinary people dearly. Herod's was a dangerous family into which to be married or to be born. He executed several wives, his eldest three sons, and possibly even more of his children. His court was equally dangerous. A premature and gruesome end awaited those who he suspected of disloyalty. Like many despotic rulers, Herod was paranoid, or perhaps realistic, about plots and conspiracies against him. In this context, overt resistance was not only futile, it was frequently fatal. Herod executed those who appealed against him to Rome. His armies and administrators acted swiftly to put down dissent and act against anyone slow to pay taxes, to pay homage, or to seed payment of other kinds. Not exactly peaceful, not exactly serene. According to the first century Jewish novelist cum historian Josephus, Herod was so intent on a legacy that he tried to ensure that his death would be met by mourning rather than celebration. He therefore ordered that Jewish nobles be slaughtered around the country when he died, to ensure that some families at least would grieve. That order was not carried out. But we're getting ahead of ourselves, because when Jesus was born, Herod the Great was very much alive. He was very much alive and in Jerusalem when wise men from the east arrived in Jerusalem asking, "Where is the child born King of the Jews? For we've seen his star, it's rising, and we've come to pay him homage." Wise men arrive in Jerusalem and ask about a child born King of the Jews? That's a contradiction in terms, if ever there was one. King Herod's ruthless elimination of possible rivals was no secret. Were these astrologers so heavenly minded that they were no earthly good? Were their heads so up in the sky that they blundered round a city ruled by a ruthless king, the King of the Jews, a king through conquest and Roman decree, and they blundered around asking, "Where is the one born King of the Jews?" You don't need to be particularly wise to know that questions like that are extremely unwise. So is the gospel writer being ironic or sardonic, sarcastic? Not in this case. Wise men is a loose interpretation of a Greek term, magoi. The New International Version does better here by transliterating magoi into magi rather than over-interpreting it. Magoi, or magi, as you probably guessed, means magician, sorcerer, which is how most English versions of the Bible translate the same term when it appears in Daniel or in Acts. So why don't they do that here? I don't know, but I suspect that Protestant anxieties about magic and magicians might be involved. Did magicians follow the natal star? Were they the first to worship the Messiah? Magicians? Sorcerers? Scandalous. We can't have that. But maybe that's the point. Scandalous sorcerer astrologers, worshippers like that, they keep good company with the scandal-scarred women among Joseph's ancestors. What's more, these magi are Gentiles of unspecified ethnicity, further bordering Jesus' mob, Jesus' people. You've got Jews, you've got Gentile women from among Israel's traditional enemies, Canaanites, a Moabite, the wife of a Hittite. These are the ancestors. And now with the arrival of magicians from the east, the scandal compounds and deepens, and the reach of the gospel goes to the ends of the earth. From Herod's perspective, of course, the Magi's question is scandalous. One born King of the Jews? Never. Herod is particularly, predictably agitated, troubled, disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. Only 30 years back, the rival Hasmonean princes and their armies had torn the city apart, seeking to be a king, but opening the way for Herod and the Romans. That city has had its fill of war and bloodshed. Its people, yes, they've suffered under Herod. But what hell might Herod unleash to eliminate this new threat? Wiser than the Magi, Herod calls the ruling priests and scribes and asks where the Messiah is to be born. He asks about the Messiah, but the Magi didn't ask about the birth of a Messiah. They asked about the birth of one born to be King of the Jews. Why then does Herod ask about a Messiah? Well, he's no fool. He's heard the Exodus story. He's watched the Passover crowds. He's heard rumours of messianic hope, hope for a new Moses, a new and greater David, a shepherd king who will rule among the people, not over them. These messianic hopes were the same as those that ushered in the Hasmonean dynasty. But that dynasty grew as corrupt and power-hungry and extravagant as any foreign rulers. So the Jews prayed and longed and groaned for liberation, and Herod knew it. According to Josephus, that novelist come historian, this won't be the first Messiah that Herod has disappeared. Wiser than the Magi, Herod consults those whose vested interests align with and depend on his own. As king of the Jews, Herod has taken authority to appoint and dismiss ruling priests and other Jewish leaders. They are his men. Although not as powerful as Herod, they, the ruling priests, have prospered under Herod's reign. They knew on what side their bread was buttered. Much as they might secretly hate and resent him, they have their interests aligned with his. So they gave him the information he needed. Where will the Messiah be born? In Bethlehem, in Judea, for that is what the prophet has written. Wiser than the Magi, Herod secretly calls them and extracts the information he needs. They don't seem to hesitate before sharing it. And then he tells them to report back. Why? So that I too may go and bow the knee, that I too may pay homage. After they had heard, and it seems believed the king, the Magi went on their way. We read on in the story and discovered that belatedly these Magi wise up a little, if only due to a salutary dream. They return from whence they came without reporting back to Herod. When Herod saw that he had been tricked, he was predictably furious. His plans are not so easily thwarted, though. He gave orders that all the boy babies in Jerusalem and surrounds be killed. Not only, Matthew tells us, had the Magi alerted Herod to the threat in the first place, where is the one born king of the Jews, they then gave him the information he needed to execute this infanticidal order. Rather than describe what happens next, the darkest, most horrendous part of the Nativity story, the Gospel writer invites us to enter the experience and grieve with the mothers whose infants were torn from their arms. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and bitter mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted because they are no more. According to Genesis, Rachel, Jacob's younger wife, the wife he loved, was buried on the way to Bethlehem. She died, you may remember, giving birth to Benjamin, whose tribal land was in Ramah. Centuries later, as Jerusalem is conquered and its people taken into exile as war captives, the prophet Jeremiah evokes Rachel and imagines her weeping for her children, those slain in the war and those going into exile. Rachel weeping for her descendants, her children, refusing to be comforted because they are no more. The Gospel writer avoids any implication that this slaughter was in any way willed or planned by God. Even so, it raises disturbing questions, questions to which we'll return. But for now, let's think about the scandalous peace that Jesus brings. Scandalous to whom? Scandalous how? Scandalous why? The Gospels are not fairy tale make-believe. Jesus was born into the real world. The infant Messiah was miraculously saved that time. God sends an angel. God works through and depends on a person, Joseph. But other children perish at the despot's command. And later, about 30 years later, Jesus too is killed. Brendan Byrne, a Jesuit, explains, when the divine power of salvation enters the world through Jesus' birth, and then in other ways, worldly authorities who are determined to retain their grip on power are inevitably threatened and inevitably act. Those determined to retain power often speak a counterfeit peace, but they vehemently and strongly resist the true peace that enables all people to flourish. True peace, the peace of God, the peace that Jesus gives, is disruptive and scandalous to those content with present arrangements. And what of the Magi? They meant well, but good intentions are not enough. They searched, they found, they rejoiced, they worshipped, they returned from whence they'd come, still rejoicing. But their pilgrimage set in motion a train of events with catastrophic consequences for others. Did they ever learn of the disaster their unwitting question had unleashed? Which leads to a question for us. Do we ever learn of the damage we might do as outsiders when we blunder in with good intentions but little awareness of a local context? Better, as Jesus said, to be as innocent as doves and as wise as serpents. This is necessary because there are Herods in each and every time and place. Brendan Byrne suggests that Herod and his associates represent hostile kingdoms that exert an oppressive hold on human life. These kingdoms might be political, or they might be economic, or they might be social. Herods and their kingdoms come in multiple forms, and they often disguise their true intentions. We need to be wise. Because of these Herods, innocents suffer when these hostile forces try and crush all resistance against them. Sometimes the destruction wrought is intentional and deliberate. Sometimes it's an unfortunate consequence of doing business. Sometimes it's not even noticed. Matthew reminds us that innocent suffering is not an aberration, but an intrinsic part of the salvation story. Because God wills it? No. Because we're not in heaven yet, and the Herods of our world are alive and well for now. And then the good news, Emmanuel, God with us. Herods are alive and well, but so is God, and God's saving presence is at work here in our world. God works salvation through people movements and ministries, through all groups who seek to reclaim the world for all of God's children, indeed for all of God's creatures. God is with us, God is in us, and God works through us. I'm going to close with a poem from this book, Dandelions and Thistles, from the Iona community. And it imagines being a woman of Bethlehem, remembering. It still hurts to think about it. Even now, decades later, if I hear a galloping horse, they came at dawn, a few on horseback, most on foot, they spread through the village. I can hear them. Shouting, swearing, laughing. I can hear the screaming, the wailing, the fear. I can hear the silence of a child's scream stopping short. My brother, Nathan, he was among them. I hear his silence. It was Herod's order, apparently. That's what kings do. They crush the poor, they destroy the opposition. Some hoped that the child Herod wanted dead had escaped and would grow and return to save us. But what good would that do my little brother, my Nathan? I heard a rumour that the child Herod wanted did indeed escape. I heard that an angel came to his father at night that warned him, and that they fled, the child, the mother, the father, they fled that very night. I heard that they were well gone by dawn. But if that's true, if that rumour happened, why didn't an angel come to my family? Why weren't we warned to flee in the night? Why were we still there in Bethlehem when Herod's army came at dawn? Didn't our Nathan deserve an angel? Wasn't he special enough to save? Angels aside, why talk of one born King of the Jews? Such talk, it only leads to trouble, to suffering, to pain. Who needs another king anyway? What good ever comes from a king? Unless there's a king who lives among us, a king who is one of us. Unless there's a king who knows what it is like to live with hunger day after day. Unless there's a king who knows what it's like to be so tired you could drop. Unless there's a king who's quicker to give than to take. Unless there's a king who heals rather than bleeds us. Unless there's a king who makes real peace, overcoming hatred and death rather than destroying all who stand in his way. Unless there's a king willing to die for their people rather than lord it over them. But can you imagine a king like that?